Welcome to the 2 Degrees Show, the UK's only weekly programme dedicated to climate change. The series takes its title from the emerging consensus that 2 degrees centigrade of average global temperature rise is a threshold that we absolutely must not cross if we are to avoid the worst impacts of climate change. Later on in today's programme, we'll be speaking to Phil Thornhill. He's the founder and national coordinator of the Campaign Against Climate Change, who have been organising street demonstrations to highlight the urgent need for international action on climate change for the last 6 years. These demonstrations have grown exponentially in size, and on Saturday the 4th of November this year, international demonstrations will take place in some 50 countries around the world on the eve of the United Nations climate change talks in Nairobi. But we start this week's programme by speaking to Martin Williams of Friends of the Earth, who has been intimately involved with the development of the massive civil society campaign for legislation that would bind future governments in the UK to annual cuts in emissions of carbon dioxide.
We started the campaign with a whole group of other organisations, from the World Wildlife Fund to Help the Aged and People on Planet, working universities around the country, various other organisations, and as well as that, Stop Climate Chaos, which is the sort of largest coalition of organisations coming together, is also calling for a bill and calling on the government to make sure the bill is in this year's Queen's Speech. They'll be having a big demonstration on the 4th of November in London, which will put more pressure on for this to happen.
And that's a massive coalition of groups that includes pretty much all the environmental and development groups in this country. Really.
Yep, development groups as well, Christian Aid, Oxfam, all sorts of other people saying just how important it is we tackle climate change. Yeah.
And what sort of level of support has the campaign had from MPs and from the public generally?
Astonishing, really. Since we launched the campaign, this is Friends of the Earth alone, not all those other groups, we've had over 100,000 people take action with Friends of the Earth. It's something like one person every 6 minutes since we started the campaign 18 months ago. A massive amount of support. In Parliament, among MPs, again, astonishing, 404 MPs have now declared that they support this bill. That's a bigger majority than the Labour Party has in Parliament. You know, if that was elected at an election, that would be described as a landslide victory. So, yeah, massive amounts of support. And real heavyweight support as well. The leaders of both the Liberal Democrats and the Conservative Party and many of the smaller parties saying that they think it's essential this bill is included in the next Queen's Speech. Yeah, there's a huge cross-party support. We have not just a majority of MPs have signed up to support this bill, but a majority in every party that is in Parliament have signed. So a majority of Labour MPs, majority of Conservative, majority of Liberal Democrats, right the way across the board.
And how many MPs so far have been met by the constituents on this issue?
We think it's about 600. It's not always easy to know because there's so many people doing it across the country.
600, and there's only 646
MPs. And we know many of those who weren't met had phone calls and letters and postcards. According to our monitoring, there's not a single MP in the country who hasn't heard from a constituent that they want them to back this bill.
So I met my MP yesterday in support of this bill, and he said that there had never been any lack of political will on behalf of the government on tackling climate change. The implication was that we don't need a bill because we're doing all right. Just relax, put your faith in the government and we'll sort it out.
It'd be nice if we could. The honest truth is, though, that since 1997, carbon dioxide emissions have been going up, not down. They're now higher than they have been since Labour came to power. Our suspicion is they're continuing to rise and probably will do for a couple of years yet. It's really hard to see how we can have confidence in the current setup and the current system. It's not just about the current government. It's just the way we actually tackle this problem as a country. The system that we have is not working. It's not putting enough pressure on politicians to act. And our politicians are working to long-term targets, which makes them think they can get away with not doing anything for a few years because they'll have to do it in 2030 or 2040 or something, and that will be too late.
One of the things I thought was interesting in David Miliband's speech was that it seemed a bit of a turnaround from the position that Margaret Beckett was always giving, which was a kind of get-out clause, really, which was saying, well, we're only 2 or 3% of the world's emissions, so, you know, what's important is an international agreement, you know, it doesn't really matter if we slip a bit at home. But David Miliband actually said, our credibility internationally depends on what we do at home. So I think maybe he's kind of starting to shift a bit, and actually seeing that it's important to get it right here as well.
I think he has been a little bit more robust in two ways. One, he has made the link between our credibility as leaders of the climate negotiations abroad, when we're actually failing to cut emissions and in fact putting them up at home. It just doesn't work. Other countries will not listen to us if we're saying, do as we say, but not as we do. It's not credible. The other thing he has picked up is actually it's morally right that we cut, and he has been very clear on that. There's two reasons. First of all, historically, we're a lot more than 2%, actually. Because we are the country where the Industrial Revolution started, we've pumped a huge share of the carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, which is there now and causing problems. And of course, the people it's causing problems for are in developing countries around the world who didn't put it there. So it's our problem, and it's morally right that we tackle it. But it's also morally right, because if you start looking around the world at which countries are only 2% or only 3%, and if they all take that attitude of we're not going to do anything because we're just 2 or 3%, that actually means that no one's going to do anything. Mm. Very few countries emit more than that. Yeah. And unless we all take responsibility for our bit, whatever size it is, frankly, then we won't tackle it globally.
Yeah. I mean, the attitude of kind of buck-passing doesn't motivate individuals. Doesn't tell them that what they do counts.
No, it's not just in climate change, but when we develop technologies in this country, then it does spread around the world, and it is picked up in developing countries. If we can develop green energy and energy-efficient vehicles and so on, other countries will move straight to that technology if we help them and support them, and they can miss out the dirty phase of development that we've had. Mm.
Business also seems to be asking for a long-term indication that government is, or the economy is going to move in a low carbon direction, and they're saying they need a clear indication that that's going to happen.
Yeah, there's a whole number of businesses have come forward and said that they are prepared and ready to invest in low carbon technologies or more efficient houses or developing better cars or whatever it might be in their sector, but that they can't do it until they're confident the government will act. And I've seen this in my job and in previous jobs, when I know that even just something small like the government promising to increase the insulation thicknesses in modern houses led companies to invest in whole new factories and whole new production lines in order to produce this extra insulation. And then when the government changed its mind and delayed it by 18 months and watered down the rules, these companies were left with these factories which weren't being used and a whole investment that was wasted. And until companies have got the confidence the government isn't going to backslide like that again, then they won't make the investment we need.
And the Sustainable Development Commission has pretty much said the last 3 years have been a wasted opportunity. And one of the main problems has been squabbling amongst different departments in the government about who's going to be responsible for the cuts. Yeah. So they're all buck-passing. What the bill seems to do is it's allocate targets sectorially, so maybe that would help end all that squabbling.
Yeah, the idea of the bill is really simple. I mean, it would force the government to do those things, but basically the bill legislates for what is actually a reality, which is that we have a limited amount of carbon dioxide that we can afford to emit in the next 50 years. And all the bill does is set that as a limit and say that we need to share it out year by year. It's just the same as if I gave you your wages for the next 50 years and I gave them to you today, rather than giving them to you monthly over the next 50 years. You would have to work out how much to spend each month so that you didn't run out after 30 years. And we just need the government to do the same thing. And they will have to decide, right, well, that means we've got so many tons for transport and so many tons for people's houses and so many tons for industry. And it may be that we can cut transport more easily than homes, in which case transport can take the bigger hit. But until we plan this and work out how we're going to live within our budget, just as you'll be planning now how much you're going to spend on your rent and how much you'll spend on your food and how much on your new bike and all the rest of it, until we start doing that with carbon, we are not going to tackle the problem.
To what extent do you think it might help also rebuild the government's political capital? I mean, it seems to have, in parallel to what's happening in the States, the government's political capital seems to be sliding due to Iraq, really, I would say.
Yeah,
this is another opportunity for them to respond to the popular will, if you like.
It would be wonderful if Tony Blair would realise that, if he really wants a legacy, that setting out and introducing a legal framework for this country to tackle carbon dioxide emissions that would be quite a legacy. That would be a really impressive one. It's really important. I think all politicians are starting to realise that whoever's Prime Minister now or whoever's the Environment Secretary, they are not going to solve climate change, because tackling climate change and solving it is a long-term project which is going to take 40 or 50 years. It's going to span more than one government, more than one prime minister, more than one environment secretary. So I don't think the people in post at the minute, we can rely on them to solve the problem. What we rely on them to do is set the framework out, get the structure right, and deliver the first few years of it before they probably move on or elections change or whatever happens. And then future environment secretaries and prime ministers continue to work within that structure and tackle the problem over the long term. That's why we need this sort of certain framework, because the problem outlives the length of one government or one prime minister.
Can I clarify, you've got a kind of carbon budget written into the bill, so many million tonnes of carbon dioxide.
Yeah, the way we've drafted the bill so far, it actually starts in 2010, but the target for 2010 is the 20% below the 1990 level that the government promised they would meet.
And that's designed to achieve an 80% cut or a 60% cut by 2050?
It would then achieve nearly an 80% cut. It would be about 78%. So that's how we drafted the bill, to get down to about nearly 80% below 1990 levels by the time you reach 2050. Now, what's happened since we drafted that bill is that the government has said it won't meet the 2010 target. And, I mean, they're claiming they'll meet 18%. The research that we had done by the Tyndall Centre said that they wouldn't even reach that, and in fact that we should expect emissions in 2012 to be pretty much the same as they are now, because all of the trends are going in the wrong direction, and it's highly unlikely that we will do anything more than stabilise, is their assessment. If we do that, because we're leaving our action till later, it means we have to cut faster. So on the work that the Tyndall Centre did, where they assumed nothing would happen until 2012, we've got to cut by 6% a year, not 3% a year. Now, the true figure, what we will have to meet, is hopefully somewhere between those two, because hopefully we will do something before 2012. I mean, we'll certainly be calling on the government to do so. But if the government sits around and does nothing till 2012, it's going to have to be 6%. If they do nothing till 2018, it's probably going to have to be 9%. If they do nothing till 2023 or 2024, we'll have used up the whole of our carbon budget and we'll have to do a 100% cut overnight. So it shows that the faster we start to act, the easier it is, which is why we need to put pressure on the government to act quickly.
Is there room for flexibility within the bill? Say, for example, the science comes out with new information saying actually we need a kind of tougher target.
Again, the way we drafted the bill, actually we didn't put that in. Largely because we think it's such an important issue that if the science changes and if our response has to change as a result of new knowledge, then the government should legislate again. The usual argument for putting targets in sort of secondary legislation and allowing ministers to change it is because something like your car tax rate can be changed every year and you don't want to have to re-legislate just to put a car tax up by 10% or whatever. But actually for climate change, it's a really significant issue and it should be debated. So we think really that the House of Commons should just debate it again if in 10 years' time new knowledge means we can either do more or less on carbon dioxide. And we should have a proper and full debate and not just allow ministers the powers to chop and change things as they think it's necessary.
There are hints by David Miliband in his speech to the House of Commons on 12th of October that the government might be thinking about actually introducing this bill now, and it might appear in the Queen's speech. So it's about what is actually going to be in it. What do you think are the key elements that absolutely must be in this bill?
I think we need to break it down, really. We are campaigning really hard to get the structure right. So we would like annual targets so that we know what the total amount of carbon dioxide emissions can be emitted each year is, and plan that out for 50 years or so. We'd then like to make sure there's scrutiny of those targets and reporting on them so that we know whether the government is on track, and so that there's some powerful independent body, whether that be a select committee in the House of Commons or an independent body outside, it probably doesn't matter too much as long as it's got the teeth it needs. If those things are in it, then we can be confident that policies will follow which will get us on track.
So if this does appear in the Queen's speech and then the government introduces some weak legislation, draft legislation into the House, what scope is there for toughening it up as the parliamentary process unfolds?
Well, it ought to be very good. I mean, if 404 MPs stick to their guns, they've signed up to say they support 3% cuts in carbon dioxide each year, annual targets, and an independent body to scrutinise it. Now, if they will keep to their word and vote for that, then that's what we'll get out of the bill.
And the House of Lords, how do you think they'll respond to it?
Again, I think if there's a good argument for why the bill is as it is, if it is rigorous and does tackle climate change, and if it is supported by the vast majority of MPs, I would imagine the House of Lords would be very constructive about it.
That was Martin Williams of Friends of the Earth, talking about the massive civil society campaign for a climate change bill. Yesterday, following the publication of the Stern Report on the economics of climate change, Environment Secretary David Miliband confirmed that the government will introduce legislation on climate change, quote, as soon as parliamentary time allows, unquote. The government's current plan, however, is to legislate for a target of 60% cut in CO2 emissions by 2050, which the government itself has acknowledged is out of date and insufficient. Also, the government is currently resisting annual targets, which are critical if we are to stay within a scientifically determined carbon budget. If you want to find out more about the campaign, go to www.bigask.co.uk. Over the next few weeks, we're going to be covering the critical United Nations talks in Nairobi and watching closely the progress there to get the kind of global action we need to avoid environmental catastrophe. On the eve of the talks, there will be demonstrations in some 50 countries around the world. The 2 Degrees Show spoke to Phil Thornhill, the man behind the campaign against climate change, who has devoted himself to organising these demonstrations.
Can I start by asking you a little bit about the history of the campaign?
Yep.
I understand it was started off from quite small beginnings.
Yes, the campaign essentially developed out of a picket on the US Embassy, which actually started way back at the end of 2000 when it was apparent that the United States was the block at the Hague climate talks. And then it really took off, not surprisingly, when the following President Bush actually rejected the Kyoto Protocol entirely and basically pushed the whole process heading for an international emissions reductions treaty into reverse. So that's what really galvanised the group into existence. And we've been going since then, essentially organising the largest street demonstrations on climate change, such as they've been since that date.
Right, and what kind of numbers did you get originally, and how's that kind of changed over the years?
Well, the initial numbers when I first stood outside the US Embassy in protest against their holding things up at The Hague was one. and then we had quite a few hundred people when we staged the Kyoto rally in response to Bush dumping Kyoto. Got much more publicity than you'd normally get for those kind of numbers, so it was quite a groundbreaking and significant demonstration all the same. It was quite difficult in many ways to keep the campaign going after 9/11, just because other issues tended to crowd it out. But we have steadily built up, and last year on December the 3rd we had 10,000 people, according to The Independent on Sunday, on the streets of London, demonstrating on climate change at the time of the United Nations climate talks in Montreal.
Right. And last year, for the first time as well, there was also demonstrations in other countries around the world on the same day.
That's right. I mean, we just basically started by acting as a de facto umbrella group for climate change on the streets of, well, London initially. And we just kept on bringing in, new groups of people as much as we could, and we simply extended that principle internationally, and we used the United Nations climate talks as the obvious kind of international signpost to focus on, and started to organise events and demonstrations in countries around the world, so that we could get a kind of global campaign pushing for what has to be global action to deal with the global problem.
Mm. And how many countries took part last year?
Well, there were more than 20 last year.
What kind of size demonstrations?
They varied. I mean, in Montreal itself, obviously, it was pretty big with tens of thousands of people, and that was where it was obviously most important too. But there was also 3,000 or so, I'm told, in Sydney and walks against the climate in all the major Australian cities.
Right, because Australia's still about the only country that's standing with the US on outside the talk.
That's right. So the demonstrations in Australia were particularly significant because they are the only developed country that's not signed up to the Kyoto Protocol besides the US.
And on the international side, you're going to build on that for this year?
Yeah, I mean, at the moment on the website, our international website, there is something like 48 countries where something is happening. Some of the things are very small, but even small things can turn out to be the biggest demonstration so far on climate change in the country concerned. So it's building up a fair bit of momentum.
And the talks this year are taking place in Nairobi in Kenya.
That's right.
And there's been some attempt to make sure that there's action in Nairobi around the time of the talks to kind of make sure that the people in the talks know that people are listening and
feel the heat, as it were.
How's that going?
Well, I've just had an email from Eric Kisangani in Practical Action in Kenya, and they're at the centre of things there. And they're reckoning to see at least 5,000 people in Nairobi, so that sounds pretty good. It'll be the first time, I think, that there's been a significant demonstration, well, a demonstration of that size anyway, in a developing country. And it's the thing about the talks being in Nairobi is that it's an ideal opportunity to make the point that it is already people in the developing world who are suffering most from a problem created overwhelmingly by the rich industrialised countries who are responsible for the emissions of heat-trapping gases that are causing the problem.
How aware are people in Kenya, do you think, of that the talks have taken place, and B, how important they are in terms of their own kind of well-being and survival, really?
On the whole, the tragedy is that amongst those people most affected, the awareness is at its lowest. And that's a tragedy. So there are people, in northeast Kenya, where there's been intensification of tribal fighting because it's fighting over cattle, and because there's been a drought, linked to global warming, that's killed the cattle. So they're fighting over the cattle, and most of those people affected in that way have no idea that actually it's decisions taken in places like the United States that are causing the conditions that they're facing. However, in Kenya, it's the NGO community which is aware, and I think they are spreading the awareness through people, so that is beginning to build up now. And we hope that actually, during the talks and with the 5,000 people involved in the demonstration, then some awareness will begin to get out to farmers and other people, in Kenya, and it'll start the process that we need people around the global south suffering from the destabilisation of global climate will begin to realise what's happening and who's responsible.
Getting back to the demonstrations in London, mm-hmm. You're joining together with the Stop Climate Chaos Coalition, who kind of split the day into two, to kind of build on their movement as well.
That's right. Essentially what's happened is that we've been a kind of de facto umbrella group getting people together on climate change on the street for the last 5 years. Finally, what's happened that probably should have happened some time ago is that a lot of the NGOs who realise that just about everything that they're in existence to work for is threatened by climate change, and they've got together to form a coalition at the sort of top bureaucratic NGO level called Stop Climate Chaos. It's organisations ranging from sort of Friends of the Earth, the green end of it, through WWF conservation agencies to development agencies like Oxfam and Christian Aid, and obviously they represent a lot of resources that are now being focused on the problem. So this time, this year round, it's not just us organising the demonstration, but we're working together with them, and we're continuing our focus on the US embassy, because we've been campaigning on that for 5 years, simply because the US is the country most responsible for blocking progress in the international talks, and our main focus is on the necessarily global solution. But they're doing a rally later in the day, to which our march is going to terminate at, which is in Trafalgar Square.
Okay, so there's a whole kind of day of events.
That's right.
Do you want to quickly talk us through what's happening?
Yeah, sure. The day starts for us anyway with a cycle ride that's gathering at 10 o'clock at Lincoln's Inn Fields, near Holborn Tube. So that will be great fun, I think, for people who like to demonstrate on a bicycle. And they'll be they'll reach the US Embassy at 11:30, at which time our kind of protest there will be warming up with a contribution from Seize the Day and other people. And the formal rally at the US Embassy, though, starts at 12, with speakers like George Monbiot, Colin Challen MP, Caroline Lucas MEP, Norman Baker MP, Zach Goldsmith and others. And then at 1 o'clock there's going to be a march from the US Embassy, a march for global climate justice, we're calling it, to Trafalgar Square, and it'll reach there around about 2 o'clock, and there'll be the event in Trafalgar Square until around 3:00.
Okay, lots more speakers and stuff happening then.
Yeah.
Okay, and do you have any idea of anticipated numbers this time?
Well, yes, good question, and always something that keeps me awake at night, actually, worrying about it. But it was 10,000 last time, and it should be considerably more. I mean, I would hope for twice the number this time round with, you know, the resources that have been available this time.
Mm. Okay, and I mean, why do you think it's important for people to be out and counted on the street on that day?
Well, it's massively important because, I mean, it's sometimes put as a kind of personal responsibility problem, like picking up your own litter, do you know what I mean, reducing your carbon footprint. But realistically, when you take, you know, a cool, calm look at the science and the speed at which things are happening and what we actually need to do, it's clearly got to be something that's coordinated at government and indeed pan-government, i.e. international level. And the only way that that's going to happen is through political engagement, basically. And so for the politicians who are on our side or more on our side than others, they are desperately looking for some kind of, you know, street-level support, some sense of a public demand for action on climate change, for them to be able to actually act. And, you know, unless they do act, we don't really stand any chance of dealing with the problem. So it's absolutely crucial. And the way the political campaign builds up is going to be critical to whether we actually stand any chance of preventing essentially the catastrophic destabilisation of the global climate.
Yeah. And what about the US? I mean, as you say, that's where it kind of counts, really. They're still holding up the negotiations and standing in the way of something that's more effective. Is there a movement building there for demonstrations on the day?
There is. I mean, it is immensely frustrating that the US is holding up progress. But the atmosphere is changing in the States, and we've seen cities having their own emissions reductions targets. We've had a lot of people across America rejecting the George Bush approach, and certainly the atmosphere is changing, but it's all happening too slowly. In terms of, there are demonstrations and events happening on the 4th of November. We've been in close contact with a climate crisis coalition over there in the States. They're probably not going to be that big. One reason is that they've got the
elections,
congressional elections, so that's overshadowing everything. I mean, they're trying to use the climate campaigners are trying to sort of use November the 4th as a way of influencing, you know, environmentally friendly voting at the elections.
Yeah.
But I think that as yet, America is a way behind us in terms of campaigning, of really seeing it as an important political issue to get out on the streets for. I think that they are behind in terms of that kind of awareness, but it will be picking up. And the whole point of our having a sort of global campaign all around the world is just to sort of generate a global moral atmosphere, if you know what I mean, where where it's regarded as unacceptable for any country to hold up progress that is essential for the whole world.
Mm. So the place to go if people want to get involved and find out what's happening is probably your website.
Absolutely, yeah.
And there's local contacts all over the UK.
That's right.
If people want to travel down with other people from around the country.
Yeah.
And also a link to the international demonstrations. So what's the website address?
www.campaigncc.org. So that's just campaignccc.org.
Okay.
And there's a link there to the global site as well. Be there and be part of the movement to save the world, basically.
That was Phil Thornhill, founder and national coordinator for Campaign Against Climate Change. If you want to hear today's show again, it will be archived shortly at www.coinet.org.uk. That's coinet.org.uk. And don't forget to join the 2 Degrees Show over the next 3 weeks, where we'll be covering the United Nations climate change talks in Nairobi.